Chapter 2. Scale. Unlike philosophy, logic, or pure mathematics, physics is both an empirical and a quantitative science. It relies on the testing and verification of ideas through reproducible observation, measurement, and experimentation. While physicists can sometimes propose exotic or outlandish mathematical theories, the only true measure of their efficacy and power is whether they describe phenomena in the real world, against which we can test them. This is why Stephen Hawking never won a Nobel Prize for his work in the mid-1970s on the way black holes radiate energy, a phenomenon known as Hawking radiation. The Nobel is only awarded to theories or discoveries that have been confirmed experimentally. Likewise, Peter Higgs and others who made a similar prediction had to wait half a century for the existence of the Higgs boson to be confirmed at the Large Hadron Collider. It's also the reason why physics as a scientific discipline only began to make truly impressive advances once the tools and instruments necessary to test theories through observation, experimentation, and quantitative measurement had been invented. The ancient Greeks may have been brilliant at abstract thinking, developing subjects such as philosophy and geometry to a level of sophistication that is still valid today. But, Archimedes aside, they weren't particularly famous for their experimental prowess. The world of physics only really came of age in the 17th century, thanks to a large extent to the invention of the two most important instruments in all of science: the telescope and the microscope. If we were only able to understand the world we can see with our naked eyes, then physics wouldn't have got very far. The range of wavelengths that can be seen by the human eye is just a sliver of the full electromagnetic spectrum, and our eyes are constrained to discerning only those objects that are not too small and not too far away. While we can, in principle, see out to infinity, provided a sufficient number of photons make it to our eyes, and given an infinite amount of time for them to reach us, this would not likely provide us with much useful detail. But once the microscope and the telescope were invented, they opened up windows on the world that dramatically increased our understanding, magnifying the very small and bringing closer the very far away. At last, we could make observations and detailed measurements to test and refine our ideas. On the 7th of January, 1610, Galileo pointed his modified and improved spyglass up towards the heavens and banished forever the notion that we were at the center of the cosmos. No doubt historians of science will dispute this simplistic claim. Galileo didn't suddenly establish heliocentrism with his observations and really only offered suggestive facts, like Jupiter's moons. He observed four of the moons of Jupiter and correctly inferred that Copernicus's heliocentric model was correct, that the Earth goes around the Sun and not vice versa. By observing bodies in orbit around Jupiter, he showed that not all celestial bodies revolve around us. The Earth isn't at the center of the cosmos, but is just another planet, like Jupiter, Venus, and Mars, orbiting the Sun. With that discovery, Galileo ushered in modern astronomy. But it wasn't just a revolution in astronomy that Galileo would bring about. He also helped put the scientific method itself on a firmer foundation. Building on the work of the medieval Arab physicist Ibn al-Haytham, Galileo mathematized physics itself. In developing mathematical relations that describe and indeed predict the motions of bodies, he showed beyond doubt that, as he put it, the book of nature is written in mathematical language. At the opposite end of the scale to Galileo's astronomical observations, a very different new world was opened up by Robert Hooke and Antony von Leeuwenhoek with the microscope. Hooke's famous book, Micrographia, published in 1665, contains stunning drawings of miniature worlds, from the eye of a fly and the hairs on the back of a flea to individual cells in plants that no one had ever witnessed before. Today, the range of scales open to exploration by humankind is astounding. With electron microscopes, we can see individual atoms, just a tenth of a millionth of a millimeter across. And with giant telescopes, we can gaze out to the furthest reaches of the observable universe, 46.5 billion light-years away. The most distant light we can see, from the edge of the observable universe, has been travelling towards us for over 13 billion years, and so shows us what the universe was like when it was very young. However, due to the expansion of space, the origin of this light is now much further away than 13 billion light-years. No other science studies such a span in scale. In fact, forget resolutions to the size of atoms. A team at the University of St Andrews in Scotland recently showed me something mind-blowingly impressive when it comes to measuring the smallest length scales. They've come up with a way of measuring the wavelength of light using a device called a wave meter to an accuracy of a single atometer, or 1/1000th of the diameter of a proton. They did this by passing laser light through a short optical fibre, which scrambles the light into a grainy pattern called speckle, and then tracking how this pattern changes with the minutest of adjustments to the wavelength of the light. And it's not only the range of length scales that physics embraces. We can also measure time from the minutest fractions of the twinkling of an eye to cosmic eternities. Here's a stunning example. In an experiment carried out in Germany in 2016, physicists measured a period of time almost too short to imagine. They were studying a phenomenon called the photoelectric effect, in which photons free up electrons by knocking them out of atoms. The process was first explained correctly by Einstein in 1905 in a famous paper for which he won the Nobel Prize many years later, and not for his work on the theories of relativity, as you may have thought. Today, this process of knocking electrons out of materials is called photoemission, and is the way we turn sunlight into electricity in solar cells. In the 2016 experiment, two special lasers were used. The first fired an almost unimaginably short pulse of ultraviolet laser light at a jet of helium gas. The duration of this pulse was a mere 10,000th of a trillionth of a second, or 100 attoseconds, 10 to the power of minus 18 seconds. Note there are more attoseconds in a single second than there have been seconds since the Big Bang. The second laser was lower in energy, its frequency being in the infrared range, and its pulse duration was a little longer than the first. Its job was to capture the escaping electrons, allowing the researchers to calculate how long it had taken them to be knocked out. The researchers found that this was even quicker, a mere tenth of the duration of the first laser pulse. What's interesting about this result is that the knocked-out electrons actually dragged their heels a little. You see, helium atoms each contain two electrons, and the ones that are knocked out feel the influence of the partner they leave behind, which, ever so slightly, delays the ejection process. It's staggering to think that a physical process taking just a few attoseconds can actually be measured in the lab. In my own field of nuclear physics, there are processes that are even faster than this, although they can't be measured directly in the lab. Instead, we develop computer models to explain the different structures of atomic nuclei and the processes that take place when two nuclei collide and react. For example, the first step in nuclear fusion, when two heavy nuclei come together like coalescing drops of water to make an even heavier nucleus, involves the very rapid reorganization of all the protons and neutrons from both nuclei into the combined nucleus. This quantum process takes less than a zeptosecond, or 10 to the power of minus 21 seconds. At the other extreme of the timescale, cosmologists and astronomers have been able to work out the age of our part of the universe so precisely that we are now confident that the Big Bang took place 13.8242 billion years ago, give or take a few million years. Our confidence in the accuracy of this value may sound arrogant to some, and even unbelievable to those who still cling to the medieval idea that the universe is only 6,000 years old. So let me explain how we come to this figure. Let me first make two important assumptions, which I will discuss in more detail later on, but will now just say that they are both supported strongly by observational evidence. One, that the laws of physics are the same everywhere in our universe. And two, that space looks the same in all directions, the same density and distribution of galaxies. This gives us confidence that we can use the observations we make from Earth, or via satellite observatories in orbit around the Earth, to learn about the entire cosmos. Doing this has allowed us to work out the age of the universe in several different ways. For example, we can learn a lot by studying the stars in our galaxy. We know how long stars can live, depending on their size and brightness, which determines how fast they burn via thermonuclear fusion. This means we can work out the age of the oldest stars, which sets a lower limit on how old our galaxy is, which in turn gives us a lower limit on the age of the universe. Since the older stars are about 12 billion years, the universe cannot be younger than that. Then, by measuring the brightness and colour of the light entering our telescopes from distant galaxies, we can work out how fast the universe is expanding, both now and in the past. The further out we look, the further back in time we are probing, since the light we see will have taken billions of years to reach us, and is thus bringing us information about the distant past. And if we know how fast the universe has been expanding, we can wind back the clock to a time when everything was squeezed together in the same place, the moment of the universe's birth. Quite separately, by studying the tiny variations in the temperature of deep space, the so-called cosmic microwave background, we can get an accurate snapshot of the universe as it was before any stars and galaxies had even formed, just a few 100,000 years after the Big Bang. This allows us to pinpoint the age of the universe even more precisely. While it's one thing to say that physics allows us to learn about the universe at the shortest and longest distance and timescales, what I find equally remarkable is that we've discovered laws of physics that apply across the entirety of these ranges. Maybe you don't find this surprising. Maybe it's natural for you to assume that the laws of nature that operate on the human scale should also work on other scales of distance, time, and energy. But this should be far from obvious. To explore this further, I will introduce three concepts that are not always taught to students of physics, but which most certainly should be: universality, symmetry, and reductionism. Universality. I'm using the word universal here in a very general sense, and not in the more specific way as understood by some physicists working in the field of statistical mechanics. There, the term universality, as introduced by the American physicist Leo Kadanov in the 1960s, is the observation that there are properties for a class of physical systems that do not depend on their detailed structure and dynamics, but can instead be deduced from a few global parameters. The first universal law of physics was discovered by Isaac Newton, although Robert Hooke's work on gravitation preceded that of Newton. Whether or not he saw an apple falling from a tree on his mother's farm, triggering him to develop his law of gravitation, or what the mathematical formula articulating this law looks like, are not important here. The crucial point is that Newton realized that the force that pulls an apple to the ground has the same origin as the force that keeps the moon in orbit around the Earth. That a simple mathematical relation can describe both processes equally well. The way objects behave due to gravity here on Earth is the same as the behavior of the moon around the Earth, the planets around the Sun and the Sun around the center of the Milky Way galaxy. The gravitational force that shapes life on Earth is the same force that has shaped the entire universe since the Big Bang. The fact that Newton's description of gravity was superseded by Einstein's more accurate one more than two centuries later doesn't detract from this insight about the universality of gravity. Einstein's general theory of relativity, which improved on the predictions of Newton, also gave us an entirely new description of reality, which I will explore in greater depth in the next chapter. Indeed, Einstein's theory demonstrates a universality that is quite astonishing, and I'll mention just one aspect of it here to highlight what I mean. The beautiful mathematical construct that Einstein presented to the world in 1915 is also still our current best theory on the nature of space and time, and it is extremely accurate. It also correctly predicts that a gravitational field will slow down the passage of time. The stronger the field, the slower time runs. This effect has the strange consequence that time ticks by ever so slightly slower in the Earth's core, deep within its gravitational well, than it does on the surface. This difference in age that has accumulated over the 4.5 billion years of our planet's existence means that the core is in fact 2.5 years younger than the crust. Put another way, for every 60 years of Earth's history, its core has aged 1 second less than its crust. This figure has been calculated using the formula from general relativity, and it's not at all obvious how we might go about checking it experimentally, but such is our trust in the formula that no physicist is in any real doubt about its veracity. If you think about the above prediction, you might find it somewhat paradoxical. After all, if we were to drill a hole through the Earth, then travel down to its center, we would no longer feel the effects of gravity, since the Earth would be pulling us equally in all directions. We would feel weightless. However, the effect on time is not due to the strength of the gravitational force at the center of the Earth, which is zero, but rather to the gravitational potential there. This is the amount of energy needed to pull a body from that location out to a place far from Earth's gravity entirely. A physicist will say that the core of the Earth is in the deepest part of the Earth's potential well, where the slowing of time is greatest. We can even measure the difference in the rate of flow of time over a height of just a few meters. A clock upstairs in your house is in a slightly weaker gravitational potential, further from the Earth's core, than a clock downstairs, and so runs ever so slightly faster. But this effect is extremely tiny. The two clocks would be out of sync by just 1 second every 100 million years. If you're feeling skeptical about all this, let me assure you that the quantitative effects of gravity on time is very real indeed. If we didn't take it into account in modern telecommunications, the smartphone in your pocket would not be able to pinpoint your location anywhere near as accurately. Where you are on Earth relies on your phone receiving signals from several GPS satellites in orbit. The time it takes for these electromagnetic waves to cover the distance has to be known within just a few hundredths of a microsecond, so that your location can be pinpointed to within a few meters. But this doesn't work if we assume that time runs at the same rate everywhere. In fact, the highly precise atomic clocks on board satellites gain around 40 millionths of a second each day, and so must be deliberately slowed down in order to match the rate of slower earthbound clocks. Without this, satellite clocks would gain time and your GPS location would drift by over 10 kilometers each day, rendering the information useless. What is also remarkable is that those same equations of general relativity that predict the way gravity causes tiny modifications to the rate at which clocks tick can also tell us about the longest timescales imaginable, mapping the history of the universe over billions of years all the way back to the Big Bang, and even predicting its future. Einstein's theory of relativity applies equally well at the shortest and longest intervals of time. But this universality only stretches so far. We know that at the very tiniest of length and time scales, the physics of our everyday world, whether according to Newton or Einstein, breaks down and must be replaced by the predictions of quantum mechanics. Indeed, as I will explain in the coming chapters, the very definition of time, according to quantum theory, differs dramatically from the way it enters into general relativity, which is just one of the many challenges still facing physicists in their attempts to combine relativity and quantum mechanics into one unified theory of quantum gravity. Symmetry. The universality of the laws of nature has fascinating mathematical origins and is linked with one of the most powerful ideas in science, symmetry. At a rudimentary level, everyone understands what is meant by a geometric shape that is symmetrical. A square is symmetrical because if you draw a line vertically down its center, splitting it in half, or doing the same thing with a horizontal or diagonal line, then swapping the two halves around doesn't alter its shape. You also achieve the same result if you rotate it in multiples of 90 degrees. A circle has even more symmetry because you can rotate it by any angle without changing its appearance. In physics, symmetries can tell us something much deeper about reality than just the invariance of certain shapes when they are rotated or flipped. When physicists say that a physical system has a symmetry, they mean that some property of that system stays the same when something else changes. This turns out to be a very powerful concept. Global symmetries are when laws of physics remain the same. There is no change in the way they describe some feature of the world, as long as some other change, or transformation, is applied equally everywhere. In 1915, Emmy Noether discovered that wherever we see such a global symmetry in nature, we can be sure to find an associated law of conservation, a physical quantity remaining the same. For example, the fact that the laws of physics don't change when you move from one place to the next gives us the law of conservation of momentum. And the fact that the laws of physics don't change from one time to the next gives us the law of conservation of energy. This has proven to be an extremely useful idea in theoretical physics and has deep philosophical consequences. Physicists are always on the lookout for deeper, less obvious symmetries that are hidden in the mathematics. Noether's theorem tells us that we don't invent the mathematics in order to have a way of describing the world, but rather, as Galileo observed, that nature speaks the language of mathematics, which is there, ready and waiting to be discovered. The search for new symmetries has also helped physicists in their quest to unify the forces of nature. One such mathematical symmetry that is not so easy to explain is called supersymmetry. We do not yet know if this is a true property of nature, but if it is, then it could help us solve a number of mysteries, such as what dark matter is made of, and whether string theory is the correct theory of quantum gravity. The problem is that this symmetry predicts the existence of a number of as yet undiscovered subatomic particles. Until we have experimental verification, supersymmetry remains just a neat mathematical idea. Physicists have also learnt a lot and picked up a stack of Nobel Prizes for their efforts by trying to find exceptions to the rules and laws that these symmetries give us, an idea known as symmetry breaking. Have you ever sat at a circular dinner table in a restaurant or a fancy function and forgotten whether the side plate for your bread roll is to your left or your right? Before any of the guests at your table touches anything, the neatly laid out arrangement of plates, glasses and cutlery is symmetric. Etiquette aside, it doesn't really matter which side your bread plate is on, but as soon as someone makes a choice and, correctly, places a bread roll on the side plate to their left, the perfect symmetry is broken and everyone else can follow suit. Symmetry breaking has helped physicists understand the building blocks of matter, the elementary particles and the forces between them. The most famous example relates to one of the two types of force acting within the confines of atomic nuclei, known as the weak nuclear force. Until the 1950s, the laws of physics were thought to be exactly the same in a mirror reflection of our universe. This idea, swapping left and right, is known as parity conservation, and is obeyed by the other three forces of nature: gravity, electromagnetism, and the strong nuclear force. But it turns out that the weak nuclear force, which is responsible for protons and neutrons transforming into each other, breaks this mirror symmetry. It doesn't lead to exactly the same physics when left and right are switched over. This violation of reflection symmetry now forms an important ingredient in the standard model of particle physics. Reductionism. Much of modern science has been built on the idea that to understand some complex property of the world, we need to break it down to its basic parts, like taking a mechanical clock apart to see how all the gears and levers fit together to make it work. This view that the whole is no more than the sum of its parts is known as reductionism, and it's been a staple of many disciplines in science to this day. The idea goes back to the Greek philosopher Democritus and his notion of atomism, that matter cannot be infinitely divided, but is instead composed of basic building blocks. Later philosophers like Plato and Aristotle argued against atomism, believing that there had to be something missing, which they thought of as the form of the thing, and which had to be added to the substance itself. Take, for example, the form of a statue. Its meaning and its essence are more than just the stone it is made of. This vague metaphysical notion isn't part of modern physics, but thinking of things in this way helps to make a clearer argument against reductionism. Let's take another example, water. We can study the properties of a molecule of H2O as much as we want, the geometry of the bonds between the oxygen and hydrogen atoms, and the quantum rules that govern this, the way water molecules stick together and arrange themselves, and so on. But we would not be able to deduce the property of wetness of water by looking solely at its constituent parts down at the molecular level. This emergent property only becomes apparent when trillions of water molecules come together in bulk. Does this then imply that the whole is more than the sum of its parts, in the sense that there is some extra physics that we need to include to explain, for example, the bulk properties of matter? Not necessarily. The idea of emergence, that there are qualities of the physical world, like heat or pressure or the wetness of water, that do not have counterparts at the level of atomic physics, does not mean that there is more to a system than the sum of its parts, provided those emergent properties are still only built upon more fundamental concepts, such as the electromagnetic force between subatomic particles in the case of water. The reductionist enterprise continued when physicists in the 19th century attempted to understand the properties of complex systems that could not be explained by the simple laws of Newtonian mechanics. Towards the end of that century, James Clerk Maxwell and Ludwig Boltzmann developed two new subfields of physics, thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, which helped physicists to learn about systems made up of many pieces by looking at them in bulk. We will look at these areas of physics more deeply in Chapter 6. Thus, while it is true that we cannot measure the temperature or pressure of a gas by looking at how its individual molecules vibrate and bump into each other, we still know that temperature and pressure are due to nothing more than the collective behavior of individual molecules. What else can there be? But while this simplistic reductionist line of thinking isn't wrong, in the sense that there is no extra physical process that magically appears when we zoom out from the molecular scale, it's of limited usefulness when trying to describe the properties of a complex system. What we require is not new physics, but more physics, in order to learn about and understand how certain properties can emerge in a system from the collective behaviours of its constituents. The Nobel laureate Philip Anderson summed this view up in the title of a famous paper, More is Different. In this paper, published in 1972, Anderson made his argument against extreme reductionism. He used as an example the hierarchy of scientific disciplines arranged in a linear order, from physics as the most fundamental science, to chemistry, to biology, to psychology, to the social sciences. This hierarchy did not imply, he claimed, that one subject is just an applied version of the one below, since at each stage entirely new laws, concepts and generalizations are necessary, requiring inspiration and creativity to just as great a degree as in the previous one. Psychology is not applied biology, nor is biology applied chemistry. As an argument against reductionism, I regard this as somewhat weak. Whether or not a concept is fundamental does not depend on how profound it is, or how much inspiration or creativity was required to understand it. But knowing that more physics is needed when we put the constituent parts, the particles, atoms and molecules together to make up bulk matter, is not the same thing as saying we know what that missing physics is. This becomes clear if we try to find a unified picture of the physical universe. We are still unable to derive the laws of thermodynamics from the standard model of particle physics, for example, or indeed to do the reverse, since it's not obvious which of these two pillars of physics is the more fundamental. And we're even further away from understanding more complex structures, such as what distinguishes life from non-life. After all, you and I are still only made up of atoms. Yet, being alive is clearly more than just a matter of complexity. For a living organism is no more complex in terms of its atomic structure than an identical but recently deceased organism. And yet, maybe we can dream of a time when we're able to have a single unified physical theory that underpins all natural phenomena. Until then, suffice it to say, a reductionist line of thinking only gets us so far, and we need to use different theories and models depending on what we're trying to describe. The limits of universality. Despite our quest for laws of physics that are universal, the limits of reductionism point to the fact that sometimes the world can behave very differently at different scales and needs to be described and explained using the appropriate model or theory. For example, on the scale of planets, stars, and galaxies, gravity dominates everything. It controls the structure of the cosmos. But it plays no role that we can detect down at the atomic scale, where the other three forces, electromagnetism and the strong and weak nuclear forces, dominate. Indeed, probably the biggest unresolved problem in the whole of physics, one we will return to in Chapter 5, is that the laws of physics that describe our everyday so-called classical world of matter, energy, space and time simply don't work when we shrink down to the world of individual atoms, where the very different rules of quantum mechanics come into play. Even at the quantum level, we often need to choose the appropriate model that is most applicable to the system we wish to study. We've known since the early 1930s, for example, that the atomic nucleus is made up of protons and neutrons. But in the late 1960s, it was discovered that these particles are not elementary and are in fact made up of even tinier, more fundamental constituents, the quarks. This has not meant that nuclear physicists were forced to describe the properties of nuclei using quark models. A simplistic reductionist approach might suggest that this is necessary for a deeper, more accurate description of the atomic nucleus. But that would not be very helpful. To a very good approximation, when describing the properties of nuclei, protons and neutrons behave as though they are structureless entities and not composite systems of three quarks. So while their properties and behavior must ultimately be due to their deeper structure, This is not apparent or necessary if we wish to understand properties like the shape or stability of a nucleus. In fact, even within nuclear physics itself, a number of very different mathematical models are employed, each applying best to a certain class of nucleus. There is no universal theory of nuclear structure. This is what I mean by the world behaving differently at different scales of size, duration, and energy. While two of the wonderful things about physics are the universality of many of its theories and the way we can understand more about a system by digging deeper and understanding how its parts relate to the whole, it is also true that we often have to choose the most appropriate theory depending on the scale we are interested in. If you want to fix your washing machine, you do not need to understand the intricacies of the standard model of particle physics, even though washing machines, like everything else in the world, are ultimately made up of quarks and electrons. If we try to apply our most fundamental theories about the quantum nature of reality to every aspect of our day-to-day lives, we wouldn't get very far. Now that we've explored both the potential and the limitations of what physics can tell us, from the power of the mathematical symmetries underpinning our physical laws, to the sheer scale over which these laws can be applied, to the limitations of reductionism and universality, we're ready to get down to business. In the next chapter, I begin with the first of the three fundamental pillars of physics, Einstein's relativity.